It is a real privilege to meet with you folks, and especially as a college and university professor and administrator, it's delightful to see young faces in the audience. I seriously debated on speaking about something else for the second service because I rarely want to do the same thing twice in a row, but then I found out more about you, and I decided I wanted to tell you a little bit about my own experience. And of course, as a teacher, you know, there are certain points I expect you to get out of this, although there won't be a quiz. First of all, I want to tell you to cherish your heritage. Cherish who you are. I'm a refugee. And I love the way that always surprises people. And I also learned four languages before I was 10 years old. One of them is Spanish. And like, I've been on a 12-day trip, and I don't know how many hotels I've been in. But in one of the hotels, a room service, she brought me something late at night, and I could tell that she was from a Spanish-speaking country. So I spoke Spanish to her, and I thought she was going to drop the tray. And she said, "You don't look like you should speak Spanish." So you're going to hear throughout my little, I don't want to call it a sermon, but the presentation this morning, be proud of your heritage, cherish your heritage, because when I came to America many, many years ago, not only had people not ever heard of my country, but it was swallowed up by the Soviet Union. And I also came at a time when people said, "Hey, you've got to become American as quickly as possible." Did anybody stop to say, "What is an American?" No. But forget your heritage. And when I finally was able to go back to my country, it was like my language was up here, but my tongue wouldn't do it. So now I'm fluent again, I'm happy to say. So I can't resist telling you that because I have gone through the whole metamorphosis of, deny your heritage. Oh, I guess it's all right to get it back, you know, those times in American history. So be proud of where you've come from and what you are. I come from a very tiny country. Way up in Northern Europe, if you look here, you can see that this is Finland, and just 85 kilometers south is our little country of Estonia, a very, very old country, dating back a couple thousand years BC, of identifiable people with a language, with a tradition, with a culture. Our problem, of course, is that we are such a desirable little piece of real estate when you think of trade routes. Somewhere this week, I had flipped on the TV, and there was a little info piece about the importance of water and how many people live near water, but like 80 to 90% of our transport of goods goes through water. So you can see why our country, even though it was very old, it was a desirable piece of real estate, and for almost our entire history, we belonged to somebody else. And we actually had the serf system, S-E-R-F, which is a form of slavery. The major thing is that we were never shipped out of our country. So when a push came for real freedom and identity, we were on our own land. I found out some very interesting things that I thought I was entirely Estonian and Latvian. My mother was from here. And then I found out that the German barons who owned Estonia and Estonians for about seven centuries and had all the land, and we worked on their land, and they weren't very nice people. They were the pirates on the Baltics, and they had nasty little habits that ended up in bastard children. And I found out that my grandfather was actually the illegitimate son of the German baron, and I had never known that. So understanding how some of our ancestry has occurred is also interesting. But you see, we border with Russia, and that has been one of the major problems of my country. This is our flag, the blue, black, and white, and this is the Parliament building and our coat of arms there. And we are a very ancient country. This is one of the pictures of the Capitol, and I will later show you a more modern picture, but you can see this dates back probably 200 years, this particular picture. And we have the influences from a lot of countries that occupied us, therefore the architecture, the culture, and a very interesting place to grow up, even though I didn't grow up there for most of my time. I was very little when we left. Estonia was a prosperous country. It was only free at the World War I time. When the Bolshevik Revolution occurred in Russia, we kind of capitalized on that, and we became free. There are a number of interesting things about that free period, especially as people saw it was time to really be progressive, to do things. The literacy rate was very high, good education, links with other countries, which, of course, was one thing that set my country apart from many others, because we had the proximity. Once radio came in, to hear and learn how other countries were doing things. But then came the war. Now, for those of you who may have found history to be a boring subject, I see some smiles of recognition. Okay, how many of you think history is a subject that you just can't wait to study? Good. Hey, you're better than most. My goodness, I'm impressed. Okay, history, of course, is a very interesting topic. If you think about it this way, what does the word actually mean? His story, and ladies, her story. Let's not forget that. So, in the historic sequence in Europe, there were two very important men. I didn't say good men, I said very important men. And if you can picture that there's a table in a room, and one of them is sitting on one side and one of the other, and their staff is standing around them, and their names are Hitler and Stalin. They have a map between them. They don't like each other, but they're going to divide up Europe. Doesn't matter what we wanted. One said, okay, I want this part of Europe. Well, if you're going to take that part, then I want this part of Europe. And they negotiated. This is how some of the world events occurred. And then came the war. And here's one of the first lessons that I'd like to have you think about as young people. How many of you vote? How many of you are active? How many of you go to town hall meetings if they have them in your community? It's important. We live in a country that I think has been particularly blessed, but you know how the communists took over Estonia? It wasn't by winning it in the war, no matter how horrible the war. It was because communists infiltrated government, and one day the Estonians woke up and said, oops, we are under communism. We have to be vigilant, and there, of course, is a lesson there. As Adventists, we also have to be vigilant that those forces that are going to keep us from a good life don't take us over. So communism came in, and the dreaded KGB, the secret police. If you have watched any movies, that's always one of the favorite topics, you know, the secret police, the Russian mafia, all those, and no matter how TV or the movies portray it, it was worse. The brutality of the communist ideology was amazing. Life was worth nothing. It's possible that one of your ancestors was an artist and did a statue for Free Estonia. You'd probably be shot because that made you subversive. Okay, maybe you said something in a meeting that was interpreted as being unfavorable to the government. They'd come at night. If they didn't shoot you, they'd send you to Siberia. And Siberia is a very hostile, very cold, very barren place. And as people were sent to Siberia, many of them wished they had been shot instead of taken there because they never came back, and it was a horrible time. So when the communists came, excuse me, and war began, people were very afraid. And one day my father got a little note in the mail. That was before email. And he got a little note in the mail that said, "You are to appear," and it gave a date, time, and a building. And he knew what that was all about, and it scared him. Now, my father was both an intellectual, but also the conference president for the Adventists in Estonia. And anybody who was a leader, whether business, intellectual, cultural, art, so forth, was suspect by the communists because they figured they could sway the people. And, of course, pastors have always been in whatever country. They are the ones that can influence people, and therefore the governments are hostile. So my father thought, okay, what do I do? And he thought about it, and he thought about it. No, it's not time to go yet, because a lot of people had escaped, especially if they could prove German or Swedish heritage, and they could escape. My father went to the appointed time. He was ushered into a room where an officer of the Soviet Army was waiting for him, and on one side there were five soldiers who were also taking notes. Rather intimidating. So the officer started to ask my father, you know, what are the Adventists doing? Are they restless? Do they have enough food? What's their political view? And immediately my father knew what was up. This was the type of interrogation that the Soviets put a person through when they wanted them to join the KGB. Now, my father couldn't say anything to his church members. He had warned them when he got this little invitation or order and had said, "Don't talk about any politics around me." And they knew what was up. I mean, this was something that was happening, unfortunately, on a daily basis. So my father was rather noncommittal, and as this guy was interrogating him more and more, he gave rather neutral answers, and he could see that the officer was getting a little bit impatient, but he let him go. He said, "All right, come back next week. I hope you have some interesting things to tell me." And several weeks went by like this, maybe a month. Weekly, my father had to go there. Well, as the officer saw that my father wasn't going to be telling him anything very crucial, very interesting, he was beginning to be a little impatient. And one day, when my father was being interrogated, the officer was rather rude, and finally, he pulled out a piece of paper from his desk, and he said, "If you don't sign here that you have come voluntarily to give information," and then a dramatic pause, "you're not going to leave this room alive." What would you do? Would you betray the people who are sitting around here? It's a serious thought. Of course, the church members were praying. My father was praying. And instead of shooting him, the officer said, "Okay, next week we want you to come to this." And he gave him an address. And my father knew the city very well. And it was an apartment. Well, Estonia is very flat. But the government building that I showed you is on a little hill. And if you're up there and you are, it has also the old medieval wall with towers and everything. But from certain places, you can look down on the city and the harbor. By the way, our highest mountain is 300 meters, and it's literally called Munamägi, which is Egg Mountain. So you can tell we're very low. My father stood up there on the hill, and he thought, "Is it time to go? Do I need to leave?" And he prayed about it, and he decided not to. Many of his colleagues had already gone, escaped to Sweden or Germany, if that wasn't always the best bet, but if they were really fortunate, to the United States. And he thought, not yet. So a week went by, and you can imagine it was a tense week for him and my mother. I wasn't born yet, but I have an older brother. And on the appointed day, he went to that apartment building, looked up the address, climbed to the second floor, knocked on the door. Can you imagine what some of his thoughts probably were? What next? Are they going to usher me in and then kill me? Are they going to shoot me through the door? What's going to happen? So to his surprise, there was no answer. Well, now, I think I would have said, okay, I tried, and I would have left. But he didn't. He knocked again. And the door opened just a little bit. And a little old lady peered out, looked at him, and my father was speechless. This was not what he expected, unless it was a spy in disguise, which it didn't look like it. And so finally she said to him, "What do you want?" Well, then he realized that with all the secrecy that the KGB practices, he didn't even know the officer's name. Have you ever tried to describe somebody, and after a while we all begin to look the same? You know, we all have noses and eyes and ears, and I often wonder how people describe me when they're going to meet me in the airport, and they usually they have a sign up, and that helps a great deal. Now, my father didn't know this person's name, so he begins describing. And the lady looks at him really puzzled, and finally she starts shutting the door gently, and she says, "There's no one here but me." Imagine that. Everybody knew, it was common knowledge that if the KGB approached you, you didn't say no, and if you didn't cooperate, you probably disappeared. He couldn't believe it. Many years later, when the denomination was going to honor 50 years of denominational service, they called me and they wanted to have me probe him. Am I having mic problems? They wanted me to probe him for some feelings because they were going to surprise him, and they wanted me to get some facts together. And I remembered him telling me that incident. The first book I ever wrote was about our escape, called To Linger is to Die. And so I asked my dad, "Why do you think that happened?" Because it was so totally out of character. And I still remember he was looking out the kitchen window. He was a wonderful gardener, and they were living in Massachusetts, and he thought about it. And then he said to me, "I really think it's because the Lord saw that I still had work to do for him." And I believe that. I think the Lord can use all of us. One person can make a huge difference. One person, and especially if you have one person with a commitment, with a vision. And I love seeing what you put up there about the homeless and those kinds of programs. I think it's marvelous. I once wrote a book called Caring is Not a Spectator Sport, because I was concerned how Christians and Adventists weren't involved enough in making a difference in their communities. And one of the reasons I like going around to the Hispanic, African American, Vietnamese, Southern Asia churches is because I have seen that you reach out to the community more, and I very much appreciate that. There's so many needs out there, and I think about the 3 years that I worked in downtown Washington not too long ago, and how many homeless we have there. And of course, the ones that affect me the most are the veterans, because they're the ones that we saw as our heroes as my story progresses. Well, the war went on. There were some really brutal things that happened. For example, this is a memorial. You see the cross there and the railroad station. This is in one of the towns where some of my relatives live. And what they would do in trying to rid the population, first of all, of men of any fighting age, which tended to be very young, to at least 40, And also, if anybody was seemed to be subversive to the government or had done anything to offend, they were just gathered up. Trucks would come on a street like this in the middle of the night. There'd be no warning. People would be brought out, dragged out of their houses, couldn't do anything. What bothers me the most is if I had to leave my dog, never mind my family. And they would just stick people into cattle cars. And Estonia, as you notice, is pretty far north. It's cold. And most people died. One time they separated the children from their parents, put them all in a cattle car, put it on a siding to hook it up to a train, and forgot about it. When they finally discovered all the children were dead, that's how brutal things were during that time. And people would, if your name was on a certain kind of list, they would just be gathered up and taken away. I have to digress and tell you one quick story. I had a wonderful uncle who was a musician. And he was one of those that was brought together and shipped out. And the last time he saw my father was he was in the back of an army truck, and my father was on a street corner, and they waved to each other, and that was the last time he saw him. So you can imagine how happy he was to meet me, his niece. Well, they were shipping out the guys, and of course they decided they had to feed them at some point so they wouldn't die prematurely before they could work in Siberia in the forests and the mines. So they took them off the train at one point, and they had a pretty nice house that they had confiscated with rather nice dishes. Now, my uncle and I are both musicians, and as they were eating, my uncle realized that as he clinked the spoons, that each dish made a different note. Now, in music flows in Estonians' veins, music and chocolate. We have some of the world's best chocolate. And he decided to keep up the morale of the people that he would organize the guys into different notes. And they began to play the old German chorales or the folk songs or the hymns, if that was the case. And then the Soviets, of course, came in and made them go back on the wagon. And many of those guys never made it back to Estonia. Well, when the relatives would try to trace where my uncle was, people would say, "Oh, you mean the man who played the soup bowls." So never underestimate what one of your talents might do for you, never mind everybody else. Okay, I have a tendency to ruin the hotel key cards through my high energy level. I must have done it to the mic. They always give me two because I run through one quickly. Okay, finally, I want to tell you one incident that has meant a lot to me because I was getting older enough to not just have impressions and feelings, but to remember some things. The Soviets were coming back. The Germans had occupied Estonia for a while, and things weren't too bad for Adventists or others because the Germans were focusing in on the Jewish people and some other undesirable populations. And they hauled in my father, and they wanted to know what he did and what was the church like, and they said, "It's okay, we'll let you function. And when Hitler is totally in power, then Hitler will be God, and then we'll close your church." So the church was able to continue on. But then the Soviets came back. You see, Hitler and Stalin didn't trust each other. No surprise there. And the Soviets were coming back into Estonia. And now my father knew that having once escaped the KGB, it was probably time to go. We got on the last train that went to the coast because the Germans had said, "We'll take anyone who wishes to come on our troop ships and we'll take you to Germany." Of course, the hidden agenda was that they would work in the factories because the Germans had lost so many men. And so we went to the big islands, which you saw on the map there earlier, and were able to get on a German troop ship. Now, most of those ships were torpedoed. And my father had a cousin who did make it to Canada, the only relative that made it out. And that man told me, he said, "The hardest thing was clinging to a piece of wreckage and having to fight off people who wanted me to save them because he knew I could only save myself. Imagine having to make those decisions. Well, we made it to Germany. And tiny as I was, I still remember how the Estonians lined the deck of the ship, the troop ship, and sang their national anthem. What a moving moment, because many of them knew they'd never make it back. Who would have thought the Soviet Union would fall apart with all its repression? So we made it to Germany. There were many close calls. I still remember some bombings. When I was living in Lincoln, Nebraska, at 11:15 every Friday morning, they test, I almost said air raid sirens, they test the tornado warnings, and I would feel it before I would consciously say, oh, it's the tornado warning, because that's from my childhood. Even though I was very tiny, some of those impressions are still there. Well, the war wound on. I was getting a little bit older, and it was over. Hitler had killed himself, and four major powers, if you remember your world history, had taken over that area: England, France, the United States, and Russia. So now you had enemies ruling one part of the world altogether. Well, things had gone well for my family. We had had many narrow escapes. My mother told me before she died that at one place we were at a railroad station trying to get to another area as the armies were advancing in Germany, and the bombs began to fall. And my brother had had it. He's 4 years older than I am, so he was more conscious of things. And she tells me that he was there on the railroad platform, little kid, and his tears started coming down, and he looks at my mother and says, "Now I want to die." He'd had it. It was rough. But we made it. We made it to the British zone. And I can still remember some of those marvelous American soldiers, as well as the British soldiers who had the Canadians with them. And I had the good sense for my first crush to be on a uniform. And I can prove that he was handsome because he has his arm around me and I'm looking up at him. I was all of 5 years old. I had good taste. So we thought everything was fine. We thought that the war was over, that we were going to be fine. Life would finally go on. My father had seven churches he was taking care of because the pastors had been conscripted into the army, and many of them, of course, had died, the German pastors. Well, one Sunday morning, my father woke up. He decided to go into the town. We were living on a farm with an Adventist farmer. And he decided to walk into town, maybe to buy the newspaper or whatever. They were starting to get a sense of normality. And he thought, my goodness, it's extra quiet, even for a Sunday. Well, all radios had been confiscated. So the only way, if you wanted people to know something, was to plaster posters on the sides of buildings, on trees, on fences. And he saw the posters. So he walked up to one of the posters and was horrified to read, "This part of Germany now belongs to Soviet Russia. Anyone caught leaving their home will be shot on sight." You see, what had happened while we were sleeping, they had decided, the major four powers met at a very important conference called the Yalta Conference, and they had decided for some reason to shift those borders. But they weren't going to tell the people because there would be this mass chaos as people would try to flee out of the Soviet quadrant. Of course, my father went home. He had the farmer and his family, and the four of us got together. And we thought, after all those miraculous escapes were caught, this is it. There was a sense of doom, and tiny as I was, I have never forgotten that sense of fear that hung over us. My parents and the farmer and his family, they prayed. And finally, the farmer said, "We've got to do something." He said, "I know. I think I can take you through the woods to a place where I think you can sneak across the border. Well, my parents tried to dissuade him, of course. Remember what the poster said? Anyone caught leaving will be shot on sight. And we didn't know if the area had changed hands yet. It was so precipitous. Well, he insisted. So he went and got his poor little cow. They had no more horses. The horses had been confiscated for use in the war. So this poor little cow had to do everything besides give milk. Hitched her up to a wagon, and he and his son were sitting in the front, and the four of us, we had very little to our name, maybe one or two suitcases. We got in the back. We started off. Pretty soon, he says, "Hey, get down. There are two soldiers up ahead." They turned out to be British soldiers, which was one of the most welcome things that anybody could think of, because it meant that it had not yet changed hands. Now, my father knew just a little bit of English, so he hopped out of the wagon and he began to talk to the soldiers. You see, our situation was that we were not considered refugees by the Soviets. We were considered deserters. And you know what you do with deserters? You shoot them on sight. So for us, it was extra dangerous, more so than for the average German. So my father got out, and he started to explain to these soldiers. Well, they listened. They were very polite. And then they whispered to each other. And finally, they turned back and said, "Tell you what, we'll let you go on if you promise not to tell anyone you saw us." Now, that must have been the world's easiest promise to keep, because we were hoping to sneak across the border, remember? So we went on. But, you know, a lot of good ideas, other people think of them too. A lot of people had thought of this one. So there were a couple hundred people there, and there was the big rolls. There were the big rolls of barbed wire stretching through there. A soldier, fortunately a British soldier, every so many feet. And having always been an animal lover, I still remember, tiny as I was, that there were deer grazing on the other side. How incongruous. Here, a panicked people, there, some deer. So my father set us down. We said goodbye to the farmer, and he went back. And quite a few years later, we found out that he got home safely. It was a real relief for my parents to know that, because he had risked his life. The difference one person can make. So my father went up to the soldier, once again tried to explain to him what our particular dilemma was. And the soldier, of course, said, "I can't do anything. But I tell you what, you leave your family back here, and I'll let you run a couple miles up the road to the Army headquarters. And if you find the right permission, yeah, bring it back to me, then we'll talk." My father thought, "What do I do? If we stay here, we're very, very likely to be killed right away." He took a chance. He ran up the road. Can you imagine what my mother was thinking? She was already in a foreign land, two little kids. She did know the language, because they, in Europe, everybody learns five or six languages. But imagine if he didn't come back, and that happened to a lot of people. So my father finally, and this was another miracle because, you know, there's bureaucracy in the Army, and he finally found the right officer, blurted out his story one more time, and the man took a little piece of paper. He didn't say much, took a little piece of paper and wrote something on it and handed it to my father. My father stuffed it in his pocket and ran back to the border as quickly as he could. This is from the book that I wrote, and this is our escape route here. You can see where we came from, the big islands, and then this way into what was then the German zone. Now it's Poland. And then we ended up here at the end of the, when everything was starting to settle down. So my father came running back, and he handed the note to the soldier he had talked to, and miraculously, they motioned for us to come. Well, you can imagine. You know how you feel when people cut line. Sometimes when I'm in other countries where getting on an airplane is just a mass chaos, it isn't the zone one, zone two. You know, it's just free-for-all, like pouring people through a funnel. You know, kind of get stuck up there. Well, you imagine how the people felt, and you could hear the murmur in the crowd. Why can't they go? Why can't we? We didn't ask. My father showed the man the note. We got through the makeshift barbed wire fence, and we headed on down the road on the free side. 15 minutes or so later, there was a rumble of huge army trucks. You don't mistake that. My dad went and hid because anybody could be conscripted, and at this point, he didn't want to take a chance. It was the Soviet armies ready to take over the border. 15 minutes. What did the note say? Here's the note. We had almost nothing when we came to America. I remember the good old Dorcas societies. Now we have community service. But in those days, it was a Dorcas society, and they tried to outfit us with things. I remember some cute bunny slippers, but my feet were too big, you know, that kind of thing. Free. Well, what did the notes say? This was my legacy to freedom, my ticket to freedom. But even more than that, it truly was a symbol of a miracle. And to me, it illustrated one more time the power of one person to make a difference. What this note says, if it were a little clearer, but you can imagine how old this is, my dad kept it. Eventually, he gave it to me, and I put it in a safe. And what it says, it's addressed to a Corporal Lee, and it says something like, if you can do so without arousing too much curiosity from the others, you can let this man and his family through. That had to be a miracle. It just didn't make sense. When I've worked in the UK, I have tried to trace these people, but unfortunately, Lee is too common, and these are just initials. Next time I'm there, I'm going to try one more time because I'd like to at least have this man's family know what one person can do and the difference that that person made. That was the last time we had to flee. We spent several more years in Germany, a little bit in Scandinavia, and then we finally got to the Promised Land. Did any of you, when you were little kids, watch the movie An American Tale? Okay, good. I love animation, but that particular movie is very real to me. And if you remember, there's a part there where the invading armies rampage through this little mouse family's crops and destroy their homes. And so they gather together in the hollow under the tree. And Grandpa Mouse says, we've got to do something, which, of course, rang a bell with me. And he says, we must go to America. In America, there are no cats. And that's really the way a lot of us felt. America was a promised land. And that's one of the reasons I do what I do, even though I've had some other exciting careers before I got into fundraising. Because it takes money to carry out good causes. It takes money to help other people. It takes money to move forward with a vision of having a better community, a stronger church, alleviating some of the pain that we see in our world. For example, I've had the privilege of training or consulting in many countries, and I will never forget when I was in Turkey, in Istanbul, they had put me in this beautiful hotel. And the conference center, actually, this amused me a little bit because I ended up teaching in the harem. I mean, the harem was long gone. It was the harem building. Well, I had long days, and one day I decided, it was about 9 o'clock at night, I decided I owed myself a break, so I caught the bus and went to downtown Istanbul. And it's about 10 o'clock at night, and I'm walking around, and I was horrified to see little tiny kids racing in the traffic, trying to get a little bit of a handout so that if they had a home, they could take that money home and not get beat up. Or if they didn't have a home, they could eat something. And I still have burned in my memory this cute, tiny little boy sitting in a doorway trying to sell matches, and they were piled very artistically in front of him, and that poor little kid was asleep like this. I just wanted to do something, and I knew that by training the people who were in the course or with whom I was consulting, that maybe they could mobilize others to do more for those street kids. And one of the groups invited me to come visit, and they had a home for street boys. And as I was going through there, and I was so moved by what this handful of people were doing. Sure, it was a drop in the bucket for the street kids of just Istanbul, but they were doing something. And so I left a donation. I didn't have a whole lot with me, but I left a donation, and they said, "We want to thank you for this." I said, "Oh, no, you don't need to do that." They said, "We want to thank you." And they took me to a room where they had materials, and on a shelf, they had note cards, printed note cards with envelopes, and they said, "Here, pick out 10 that you like." And to this day, I will never forget, because as I looked at those note cards, these were drawn by the street kids. You know what was on every note card? A house, a home. That's what those kids wanted. I kept those cards for the longest time. That's what a difference we can make. Well, we ended up in America, and as I started out saying to you, I tried very hard to be American, but then in 1991, when the Soviet Union broke up, I waited a year because the Soviets didn't leave for another 4 years, even though the country was declared free, the UN recognized it, the US recognized it, but the Soviets were there, and I was afraid. But I got to go back 1 year later. We still, in those days, had to be placed by a travel agent in a hotel. It was a huge monstrosity from the Soviet times, now converted to a luxury hotel. And here was what was interesting. It was a block away from my dad's church. I was able to go find the church. I was able to close the cycle for him. I was able to tell him, "Your people understood why you had to leave," because he always had that feeling that he deserted his country, his family, his church. People understood. He died a year later. I wish he could have gone back. But as you can see, I come from a very interesting country, a lot of influences architecturally from the eras as well as the people who occupied my country for centuries, and it's cold. And this is an overview looking out at the Baltic, very similar to what my dad must have seen when he said, "I guess it's time to go." But I've been privileged to go back, and a year or so ago, I happened to be there when it was an anniversary of one of the major bombings, when a third of the city was destroyed and so many people lost their lives. It was a sober moment. The president was there with two police. Can you imagine that? Obama just coming up with a crowd with just two police. Kind of interesting. And my relatives had very thoughtfully gotten candles that we placed on the wall. It was a very meaningful moment for me to once again remember how much God had blessed me, but also how much God had used individual people one at a time. And I like to think this is eighth or ninth century tower, and there's a parliament building attached to it. It's a Danish old tower. The Danes also occupied us. And you can see the flag up top there. Just an interesting sidelight. When it was turned over to the Soviets, there was a pair of journalists, a husband and wife, who were Estonian, but they were turncoats. They were cooperating with the Soviets, and they took the flag down. And when Estonia became free, their daughter, now almost 50 years later, who was also a journalist, helped put it back up. Very symbolic of that period of time. But I look at this old tower, and I think of various Bible texts that I'm sure that you are aware of. One that comes to mind is the one about God is our refuge and our strength. And I like that text. God is a mighty fortress for us. And we may never know, as much as I know about my background, how much God has saved us, but also I will never forget one person made a big difference. And I want to challenge you to think about that. What can you do, both individually as well as collectively, to make a difference in this world? In all these years that I have worked with about every kind of organization, I'm still connected to Indiana University Center on Philanthropy, and I've taught just about everything you can think of, for example, UNICEF. And one of my assignments was to teach people from 20 countries in Paris. That was one of my hardship gigs. But things like that, where I think about how people come together so they can learn how to make a difference. And that's one of the joys of my job. And I hope you think about, where can I make a difference? I finally got my citizenship at 13. And I'm happy to be an American. I'm doubly blessed because now I can also reclaim my heritage. Citizenship meant a whole lot to me, even though they changed the spelling of my name and I was too young to protest. But I won another citizenship. And here, as the Apostle Paul says, our citizenship is in heaven. That's what I want next, don't you? May God bless you, especially as you maybe are starting with your careers, as you are thinking about what you're doing in this world. You have a role. You can make a huge difference. God bless you.